There is a thing that I have asked of you, and I haven't been urgent about it, but I want it for you. You're not going to do this for me, but I want you to read 1 through 6 every week until we finish chapter 6. And I think as you do that, you'll see why. Because we're taking this bits and pieces, and it can be like looking at a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. But if you've read the whole section, you'll start piecing it together yourself, and you see the bigger picture. And I want you to be able to see the bigger picture because Isaiah is a huge book. And I'm not going to try to dumb it down, but I'm also not going to try to overwhelm you with the abundant information that's available in the book. But we're going to look at chapter 2 a little bit more, the first 4 verses. Just that will be our review section. But oh, I had a thought. When you have a thought, Rachel, write it down because it might fly away. They often do. But it had to do with the relationship between God as a covenant maker and his people as covenant people. And when you think of that, I will be your God, you will be my people. What is the just bottom lining it? Not in a lot of detail, but just it kind of two bullet points, really. What would you say that God's part of that covenant would be? That's a good one. Yeah. Protect, provide, oversee in Abraham. Okay, so what's man's part of the covenant? To be guided. Follow. That's the best word. Follow. Jesus said, come, follow me. And so I will lead you through life. You follow me through life. How do we know what we need to do to be followers? I mean, how can you tell if you're following? What is a key aspect of following God that you can know that you're following God?
The
That's a good one.
instructions are given.
You're listening to him, whether it is through his word directly, or whether it is through the encouragement or reproof of a brother, or whether it's God standing in your way. You're listening to him, letting him guide you. Okay, so we have these two key elements of God wants to take care of us. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 24, how often I wanted to gather you to me, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. Now, what's going on with that picture? Protection, provision, guidance. We have Linda and I and Halcyon and Johnny have watched as the cat that came into our lives had kittens is now training them in the ways of hunting and self-preservation. She's a marvelous mother. And so that's what God wants. But he's only able to do that because we listen and follow. They follow me. He doesn't strong arm or force anybody. So with that in mind, let's go back and remember from chapter 1, I raised sons and they rebelled against me. How brokenhearted God was, and what the consequences would be in the lives of that society who was so rebellious to God that they'd rather go to an idol and make a peace treaty with a foreign nation or hire somebody like that rather than depend upon God. I want you to depend upon me for your provision, for your protection, for your guidance. Now we'll hire this guy over here and we don't like your rules, so we'll do these things over here. And how it broke God's heart. But from the very beginning, God wanted man. Genesis 2, the first few verses, God rested. We read in the book of Hebrews that God wanted, chapter 4, God wanted man to participate in that rest. I want men to rest with me. And so it broke his heart when they didn't fall in, but it was still what he wanted. So we read here in chapter 2, 1 through 4, it will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of Yahweh will be established as the chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem, and he will judge between the nations, and will render decisions for many peoples, and they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. God, as the maker of a covenant, Alan put his finger on it, to protect his people, to provide for his people. We, as the followers of the covenant, listen to him. Did you see any elements of that as we read through here? Let's, verse 3, for example, let's go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may do what? Teach us his ways, so that we can walk in his path. So there's the following, right? There's the being guided. He will judge between the nations and render decisions for many peoples. What's he doing there? More than that, being a deliverer, you're not going to crush my people. I'm the one, and not that foreign king, it's not that nation's God, it's me that will render the judgments that will set you free. And so, as a result, they'll hammer their spears in swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. What's the picture? We're not to fight anymore. Can use the natural resources instead of making a weapon, make something to plow the ground and bring up a harvest. And they'll never again will they learn war. Right? And that's an impressive. Never again will they learn why were people in the days of David, say, or in the days of even Isaiah, who was writing this, why were they learning war?
Because they had to, and because it was dangerous.
This. If they're not trusting God to protect them, they got to fight for themselves. Now, we're going to get at some really exciting stuff when we get into chapters 38, 37, 38, 39 of the King Hezekiah's stand against Sennacherib and failing to, re refusing to yield to him, and how God gave him a victory. They didn't have to prepare weapons, God just gave him a victory. And so he says, but when was this going to come? It'll come about when? Yours says later days. Okay. Others say in the last days. And we had quite a conversation on that last week, both during class and after. And typically when you hear the word the last days, what comes to what you go out to Joe Schmo on the street and you tell him, ask him, what do you know about the last days? What's he going to say? Jesus going to back? It's going to be end of the world. He might say, I think we're in them, because we got this orange Hitler, and it's kind of like the Antichrist, and I think we're in the last days. Everybody can point to what they don't like about what's going on and say, this must be the end of time, end of the world, end of time. It's coming to an end. Okay. But there are things in this text that say that that can't be, because when the last days come, what's going to happen? People are going to be streaming to the mountain, God's mountain. That's when his kingdom would be raised up and established, and people come and hear about him and walk with him. But if last days means the end of the world, how can you walk with him when it's when it's over. See, so there's something in the text that says last days can't mean end of earth time. Well, if it doesn't mean end of earth time, what does it mean? Now, we're not left to our own devices to figure that out. Here in Acts chapter 2, now Joel was a prophet who was a bit earlier than Isaiah, and he was talking, he was predicting the invasion of Assyria. Isaiah is living at the time that Assyria invaded, and he's predicting the invasion of Babylon. But in Acts 2, Peter quoted from Joel, and he says in verse 16, this is what was spoken of through the prophet Joel. What's the this in that statement? This is, they asked a question. What does this mean? This is, wow, everybody's speaking in a language that we, that guy speaking in that language, this apostle, they were speaking in languages that everybody in the auditorium could understand, or the plaza could understand. What does this mean? Oh, they're just drunk. Now, those are the two responses. And Peter says, can't be too drunk. It's too early to get drunk. But this is what Joel talked about. Now, what did Joel talk about? Verse 17, and it shall be in the last days, says God, that I'll pour forth of my spirit upon all mankind. So what was happening there on the day of Pentecost? God was pouring forth his spirit, beginning to do so. He didn't pour it on Gentiles yet. These were all Jews. But I want you to notice that Peter said, this is what Joel was talking about. This is the last days of the prophets. Not some future time, but right there when the Spirit was poured out. In Hebrews chapter 11. No, I'm sorry, Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews 1, the Hebrews writer says, there he is. What did he say there? God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets and in many portions and in many ways, in these last days, has spoken to us in his Son. Now, do you understand this? That his Son was already dead when the Hebrews writer wrote this. The Hebrews writer said that Jesus spoke in the last days. Jesus spoke in the last days. And Scott, that was still under the covenant of Moses, wasn't it? See, which just puts the kibosh to the theory I was raised with, that the last days refers to the entire period of the messianic days. Jesus spoke in these last days, and it was still under the covenant of Moses. So it can't be talking about the covenantal periods, whether patriarchal, mosaic, or messianic. It's something other than that. In James 5, as they were, and I hope you're taking note on these things, because this is a, as we saw last week, there are people like Jan that are just absolutely convinced that the last days are something that Earth is still looking forward to. And I'm not going to fall out with that, other than to say, either you're going to be honest with the text or you're going to hold on to your opinions. And everybody gets to make that choice for themselves. But Peter or James says, come on now, you rich, verse 1, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted. You ever seen gold rust? Now, silver will tarnish, but gold rust? He's talking about becoming useless. And it will be a witness against you and consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Now, who was James talking to, Scott? Who was James talking to? Who was James talking to?
Wasn't talking to me.
Wasn't talking to anybody on this side of the ocean. He was talking to the people that were having, that were giving the brothers difficulty withholding their wages, unfairly paying them, dragging them off into court because they had the power of wealth. He said, your wealth is useless. You stored it up in the last days. My wife said something years ago that I thought was very profound. Not that she's not said other profound things, but this one really was profound. She says something like, I think the Christians in the first century were like insider traders. They knew what was coming, and so they divested themselves of their property so they wouldn't lose it, and they could use the money to advance their cause. Go ahead.
This is one of those good ones where you have to know what the word use is.
Is that like having to know what is?
Yeah. It doesn't mean a female sheep.
No.
And it doesn't mean people 2,000 years from now.
No, it means those that were making life difficult for the poor Christians. Because you're about to face your Waterloo. Your money is going to be worthless. The things you stored up and the way you've done it, not gonna make any difference to your quality of life because you stored it up in the last days. And then that passage that Scott shared with Jan, and you need to know this one. Second, First John 2, verse 18. John says, children, it is the last hour. Now, if you got a time called the last days, you might think maybe an extended period of time, like I could say back in my father's day. Well, was it at a 24-hour period? No, back at a period of time when life was like it was for him. Here we have, it is the last hour. What do you suppose that meant to John when he said, it is the last hour? When the Hebrews writer said in chapter 11, he who is coming will come very, very soon. Hosan, Hosan, Mikra, very, very soon, or very, very little. In a very, very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. What do you suppose if I say, in a very, very, in a very, not just a very little while, but in a very, very little while, that door is going to open? What do you think? Well, 2,000 years from now, somebody's going to open the door. That's not what you think. And so John says, brothers, it is the last hour. And so what I'm proposing to you is that these writers were not looking at the end of earth time, but they were looking at the end of covenant time. The covenant of Moses was about to come to an end. It was about to close in on them, and it would not do it pleasantly. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 2, about verse 14, I think it is, about 14, 15, and 16, but I think it's 14. He says, because they killed the Lord Jesus and they persecute us and they hinder us from preaching the gospel to the Gentiles, that they might be saved. Therefore, the wrath of God has come upon them to an end. We're going to bring them to an end with wrath. And we're going to see what that looks like in our study here tonight. Now, I didn't mean to take quite so long in reviewing the last days, but it's such a matter of confusion and contention. I wanted you to at least have those passages in your head so that you can say, well, here's what it appears to be to me, that the covenant of Moses is coming to an end. Jeremiah 31 says, I'm going to make a new covenant. It's not going to be like the one I made at Sinai. It's going to be different. It's coming to an end so the new covenant can begin. And there are places in the book of Hebrews where you can read, for example, chapter 10, he is, at the time of the writing of Hebrews, he is taking away the first that he might establish the second. We got that transition. You got the end of one and the beginning of the other. I'm firmly convinced that when I read the last days, that God is telling me that I'm going to do these things when the covenant of Moses comes to an end. In fact, I'm going to bring the covenant of Moses to an end because of the corruption of the people, which is what we're seeing My sons ignore me. They don't listen to me. They don't follow me. They'd rather go after the necromancers and various things. All right, enough about that, unless you have thoughts or comments. Now, it says that he may, verse 3, that he may teach us his way, that we may walk in his paths, for the law will go forth from Zion and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. Anybody know what Acts 1, verse 8 says? You don't need to know, that's verse 70, you don't need to know what is in my power, but you will be my witnesses where? Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the world. Okay, that word world was the Roman Empire. That's what that word meant to them. So we see the spread of the gospel from Jerusalem. What happened in Acts 2? Jews, devout men from every nation, came to the temple, and when they were there, the Spirit was poured out upon the apostles, and the apostles began to speak the word of God. So there's a very key four verses, which is why we spent so much time on it. But now let's go on into, and unless you have other comments. Hello, Dallas. Come on in, guys. Yeah, just missed the review, but it'll be up on, if Rachel does her job and I do my job and then Rachel does hers, it'll be up on our website soon. Maybe. Okay, so we're now looking at Isaiah 2, 5. Come, house of Jacob, and let us walk in the light of Yahweh. You see how that connects up to verse 3? For you have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because, now watch the because here, verse 6 and 7. Because, now, what I want to do is I want to read the rest of chapter 2. Because there's things I want you to note on the way by, and actually I want you to see if you find, because there are going to be some repeating patterns. Some repeating patterns. See if you pick up on them. Okay? So just read. Because they are filled with influences from the east, and soothsayers like the Philistines, and they strike bargains or strike agreements with the children of foreigners. The land has also been filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. The land has also been filled with horses. There's no end to their chariots. The land has also been filled with idols. They worship the work of their hands, that which their fingers have made. So the common man has been humbled, and the man of importance has been abased. But do not forgive them. Enter the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of Yahweh and from the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and Yahweh alone will be exalted in that day. For Yahweh of hosts will have a day against everyone who is proud and lofty, and against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased, and against all the cedars of Lebanon that are lofty and lifted up, against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the lofty mountains, against all the hills that are lifted up, against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the beautiful craft. And the pride of man will be humbled, and the loftiness of man will be abased, and Yahweh alone will be exalted in that day. But the idols will completely vanish, and men will go into the caves of the rocks and into the holes of the ground before the terror of Yahweh, and before the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. In that day, man will cast away to the moles, into the bats, their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, before the terror of Yahweh and the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. Stop regarding man whose breath is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed? All right, so here's the reading. Did you catch any repeating thoughts, phrases, ideas, Did you see the motif developing? Rachel's nodding her head, so that means you get to speak first.
That men kept on raising themselves up and brought down.
Yeah, what does abased mean? Abased.
Mine says brought low.
Brought low, that's what it means. Brought down to the base or the basement. Okay. Any other repeating motifs or thoughts? Terror and splendor. You saw that three times. You see the terror before the terror of Yahweh and the splendor of his majesty. So you have it there in verse 10. You have it again in verse 19. You have it again in verse 21. The terror of Yahweh and the splendor of his majesty. Okay, any other repeating thoughts or themes?
And came the mountains keep coming up.
Caves and mountains, yeah. Going to the caves. What are they doing when they're going into the caves? Hiding from what? From the terror, from the invading army. You can't hide from God, but you can hide from the soldier that was sent by God until he says, "Hey, look in the cave." But still, that's where you go. And what about the idols?
Really.
Being thrown away? You see them being thrown away as useless. And so let's go back now. We picked up a few of the key motifs. Go back and work our way through it. He says in 8, you have abandoned your people. The thought in verse 6 is, let's walk in his light because he's abandoned us. Why had God abandoned his people?
They went their own way.
They went their own way. They decided they knew what they wanted to do, and it wasn't what he wanted them to do. Well, you got a God who's promised to provide for you, protect you, guide you, provide it, just everything. He said, "Well, I'm going to go do it my own way." All right. That these things that I want to do for you, including protection, you don't want them. So you're on your own. You know, there's not a scarier thought in the world to me than to be on my own in this world without God. Like, there's just so much wickedness out there. It's a scary thought. But that was one of the consequences. So you have abandoned your people, verse 6, because. Now look at, did you see that? I think there are like five reasons that he gives. Because they're filled with influences from these. Who are they listening to? What ideas are they following? It's saddening, disheartening, alarming to me how in our culture, so much emphasis is being placed, and so much focus and elevation of the culture of the previous occupants of this territory, the Indians. And there's a reason if you follow through the text of the Bible, there's a reason people keep the land they're on. There's a reason they get kicked off of it. And idolatry is one of the reasons, and gross immorality is another of the reasons, and savagery is another of the reasons. And you read Indian history, and they had all three. They had all three, not necessarily within the tribe, but against the other tribes. It's just cruel. Anyway, filled with influences rather than influences from God, you're filled with influences from these soothsayers. What's a soothsayer? Yeah, a fortune, like the Philistines. They strike bargains or agreements with the children of foreigners. What do you suppose he's talking about there?
Marriage.
Could be marriage, could well be marriage. It could also be alliances, foreign alliances for military support. Okay, rather than trusting God. And their land has been filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasure. What's he talking about there? Avarice, greed, focus on material possessions, material accumulation. Yeah, Where is your trust?
Or do you trust it in
And they would sugarcoat that or put a placebo effect or some kind of front on it by saying, obviously, I'm blessed by God, otherwise I wouldn't be this rich. And you remember what the apostles said when Jesus said, it's almost impossible for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And they said, well, then who can be saved? They thought the rich were already there and the poor didn't have much of a chance. So the rich are not hardly going to make it. Then who can make it? But their confidence was in the accumulated wealth, and it was a false confidence because they took that as God's approval. All right? And so the land is filled with that. There's no end to their treasures. The land has also been filled with horses. There's no end to their chariots. What's that?
Well, that was Moses told him, don't do that.
Yeah, this was for verboten if you're German. Why? What's the point?
Because now you're relying on your military strength.
Build up a military power rather than trusting God. And again, when we get to chapters 37, 8, and 9, we're going to see Sennacherib's impressive army. 185,000 died in their tents overnight, and Hezekiah didn't have to lift a bow. Now God can do that, see, but they're not trusting God. They're embellishing their military. The land has also been filled with idols. They worship the work of their hands. There's an innate desire within man to worship a higher power. What is it that Solomon said, Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11? He has placed eternity in their heart, but they can't figure it out. It has to be explained by God. But there's this eternity in the heart of people. Some want to build an empire to carry on their name. Some want to just have a lineage, a family lineage to carry on their name, or be a sports hero and get written in the record book to carry on their. We're driven in all different ways to fulfill that inner desire to carry on. Here, we worship idols. There's that yearning for man to find something bigger than himself. You know what's pathetic about that, Rachel? They had it with the God who brought them out of Egypt. They had it, and they saw it, and they lived it. They experienced it. They were the result of it. And they turned their back on it for some reason. Okay? They worship the work of their hands, that which their fingers have made. So man has been humbled. And common man, important man, probably is accurate to man and man, big guy, little guy, everybody. Been humbled and abased, but don't forgive him. I mean, look at you, old man, I feel so sorry for you. You lost everything in the stock market, but you lost it because you didn't trust me. So don't forgive him. Is God unwilling to forgive Pam? Now that wasn't was is God unwilling to forgive Pam? No, he is willing to forgive, isn't he? And the death of Jesus is good proof of that. So why not forgive them?
Amen.
They're not changing their mind. This is their culture, and they're sticking with it. Okay? So he says, into the rock and hide in the dust. What's going on with that? Into the rock and hide in the dust. Doesn't that imply you're going to be invaded and you're going to have to try to elude the soldiers that will murder and rape and torture? So this is not a pretty picture. He's saying it in real gentle words, but he says, and this is the part that shocks me, from the terror of Yahweh and from the splendor of his majesty. You see how those two work together? What's the terror of Yahweh? In this case, in this particular case, the invading army. Isaiah was at the time when Assyria was about to invade. 100 years later, Babylon invaded. But Isaiah is particularly concerned about Babylon because he's preaching about Judah and Jerusalem rather than about Samaria and Israel. What can you tell me about the nature of the Babylonian army. Ruthless. My mother wasn't there. Okay. My mother's name was Ruth. Okay. But read Habakkuk 2, read Habakkuk chapter 1 and see what a man living at that time thought about God bringing the Babylonian army in. And just, that's all I'm going to say. Just go read Habakkuk 1. And so, but he says it's the terror of Yahweh, but he's also, it's not just the terror of Yahweh. What else is it? The splendor of his majesty. Have you ever considered that the invasion of the Babylonians to destroy the temple was displaying the splendor of God? Have you ever thought that the invasion of the Romans to destroy Jerusalem and tear down the temple was the glory of God being manifested? If that's what it's saying, tell me about that. How does that make sense to you?
People are saying what is capable of us.
I like that. And go ahead. What he's capable of?
What he told them he would do, and he's just fulfilling what he said.
Yeah, that he was a God who kept his word. We have this idea, perhaps desiring it to be so, that God is such a loving, compassionate God that he won't follow through on the horrible things that he warns about. But he's a God of protection. And when we're under his, what's the word? Under his protectorate, nothing bad will happen. But when we're outside, and when we get to chapter 5, we'll see this again. When we're outside of his protection, whatever happens, happens. It's not necessarily that, okay, I'm going to follow you around and zap you with lightning and do this, but bad things will happen, and he will get in our way. So the terror of Yahweh is also the splendor of his majesty. I want you to note that. Those two are not contrasting ideas. They're the same idea. When God keeps his word and punishes these people, that's glorifying him. He's a God of power, a God who can be trusted even when what we're trusting him for is something that is very distasteful to us. So he says in verse 11, the proud look of man will be abased. God knows how to humble a person. Now here's the interesting thing. He asks us to humble our hearts before him. He asks us to. And when we willingly do that, it's all good. But as a nation, this is not talking about individuals as much as it's talking about the individuals within a nation which is being judged for its decline into depravity. God knows how to take the proud look off a man and bring it down to, wow, look what happened to me. Why'd it happen to you? Because of the choices you made. God knows how to do that, and he alone will be exalted in that day. Now, here's a thought for you, because we're going to have this phrase in that day frequently. In that day, what? And so the question is, well, in that day, what day? Okay. And he started the chapter by talking about in the last days. Okay. But what he continued with is something that would be completely applicable to the culture that he was preaching in at the time. And yet, what's the word the New Testament uses allegory, it uses parable, it uses shadow of the good things to come. That what's happening here and the reason it's happening here is just a foreshadow of what's going to happen. Because we're talking about the last days when God's mountain will be lifted up. But what Israel was about to suffer because of the attitudes they had would be what they were going to suffer at the last days. Does that make sense? You track with that? If not, ask me, because it's really an important concept. And don't go home saying, "Well, I wonder what Rod said," and have not asked me about it, because it's here. Let me illustrate before Scott comes up. In Galatians, I think it's chapter 4. Maybe it's in the 3. Paul talks about the allegory of Sarah and Hagar. Now, Hagar had a child the natural way. His name was Ishmael. Sarah had a child according to promise. His name was Isaac. There came a time in the raising of those two boys that Ishmael was making fun of Isaac. And Sarah said to Abraham, "Cast out the bondservant and her son. They'll not inherit with my son." And Paul says that's talking about what God is about to do today in the book of Galatians. Those who are still the children of the flesh, that is, keeping the covenant of Moses, are persecuting those who are sons according to promise. They will not inherit. These will. So there's the actual history, but Paul says it was a picture of what is happening today. And that's what I'm saying here. This actual history of Babylon invading Jerusalem was a picture of when Rome invaded Jerusalem in the last days. Does that make sense? I mean, you follow track on that? Okay.
Rod,
Yeah.
so it's if Isaiah is speaking 25 or 35 years before Assyria takes Israel, isn't he talking maybe possibly about the end of Israel right here, and then later he'll be talking about the end of Judah by the Babylonians? And then later.
There's a couple reasons I think not, Jim. The Assyrian is in fact on the event horizon, but you go back to the beginning of the book, he says about Jerusalem and Judea. I'm preaching about them and what's going to happen to them. And then you get into chapters 13 and 14, 12, 13, 10 is Assyria, but it just blends seamlessly into I'm talking about Babylon. So he doesn't emphasize what's going to happen to and through Assyria as much as he emphasizes what's going to happen through Babylon. And I think the reason for that is the Assyrians never ever conquered Jerusalem. They tried, couldn't. But Babylon did. And so I think that those are the two reasons I glom onto to say, yeah, there's stuff in here that deals with Assyria, but he's really concerned about the destruction of the temple and how that presages the destruction of the temple at the changing of the covenant.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I always look at this as the first four verses we're talking about the last days. And then in that day, I think I always took it that he was talking then directly to Israel
No, I
in that
agree.
day. Is that true?
I agree.
Oh, okay.
I agree that,
So there's a double meaning.
but he is connecting it to the
Okay.
last day's prophecy. And then the New Testament writers come along and draw out those parallels for us. Okay? So, for Yahweh of hosts, verse 12, Yahweh of hosts. Now, notice it starts with the word for. In verse 11, it says, Yahweh alone will be exalted in that day, for Yahweh of hosts will have a day of reckoning. His exaltation will come because of the day of reckoning against everyone who's proud and lofty, against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. The idea of the arrogance of man that resists God, thinks it knows better than God. Of course, that doesn't happen today, does it? So, I know how to abase it. Now, I want you to land on that thought really hard, that you might be concerned about the big mouths, arrogant big mouths that put Christianity down. And what can we do? Well, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? You can pray about God, trusting that God will take care of it. Stay the course. Stay the course. Don't become frightened or alarmed and thus in panic. Do something. Run out in front of God instead of following behind him. There's a lot of things. But he says, I can abase them. You might not be able to. You might not. I mean, there's some guys out there. What's that mathematics professor in England? What's his name? John something or another. No. Who is a very eloquent defender of the faith.
Oh, that old guy.
Yeah. I mean, he's just very, very articulate. And I'm not like that. See, I'm not, I can't do that. But I can see the course. Okay. God can bring him down. Verse 13. So here's God is going to have a day of reckoning, or a day, it says of reckoning, but in italics, God's going to have a day against everyone who's lofty and lifted up, against everyone who is everyone who's lofty and proud, everyone who's lifted up, against the cedars of Lebanon that are lofty and lifted up. What's he talking about? The cedars of Lebanon, trees? Then he talks about the oaks of Bashan. Is he talking about trees? God's against trees? Trees don't have attitudes. Yeah, the prominent people, those who would Solomon's house and his palace in which he received the foreign kings, made of cedar of Lebanon and oaks of Bashan against all the lofty mountains. Notice as we read through here, lofty, lifted up, high, fortified. I'm against everything that is arrogated. And men might think, wow, that's impressive. So look at the, and what about a ship of Tarshish? What a ship of Tarshish? Anybody know what that is? Yeah, but it was more than, I mean, there are a lot of cargo ships, but a ship of Tarshish was a ship that was equipped by the Phoenicians to sail all the way to Tarshish and back. Tarshish was out on the coast of Spain. And so they were, you can read maybe later in this book, but certainly in the book of Ezekiel, just how arrogant. Mean, the ships of Tarshish were like the Rolls-Royce of ships. They're elegant, well-equipped, vermilion and purple and just decked out. I'm against that. I'm against all this arrogance of promoting yourself and making yourself look like you're something. And all the beautiful craft, the pride of man will be humbled and the loftiness of men will be abased, and Yahweh alone will be exalted in that day. So there's that. Connect that back up to verse 11. The exaltation of Yahweh alone in that day. So where do you want to be? You want to be following the guys that got the fancy robes on and are promoting idolatry and get rich quick schemes? Or you want to follow what did John the Baptist look like? Camel hair and eating wild locusts and honey, or locusts and wild honey. Which guy do you want to follow? The guy that looks like he's got the world in his hand, or this guy out here that's living in the desert? I guess it depends upon which one is speaking for God, doesn't it? And God says, I'm against the loftiness. I alone will be lifted up. The idols, verse 18, will completely vanish. And men will go into the caves of the rocks, into the holes of the ground, before the terror of Yahweh, when he arises to make and before the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. We haven't talked about that phrase, have we? Make the earth tremble. When he makes the earth tremble, what's trembling? The earth.
Earthquakes.
There, I mean, what is it that's trembling? People? People tremble. And the earth is the word earth here, eretz is the Hebrew word, it's parallel to the Greek word ge, which means the land. It doesn't mean the globe. It means the land. Who was it? Arthur, was it? This land is your land. This land is mine. Woody. Okay, Arlo's father.
Arlo's father.
This land is your land. This land is my land. What's he talking about? Our land, the United States of America. When the Hebrews talked about their land, where were they going when they left Egypt? To a promised land, or a land of milk and honey. And so the land, their land, their inheritance. Okay. He's not talking about the globe. He's talking about how things would be shaken up on their territory. What does Hebrews 12 say? All right. You don't know what I'm asking, so I'll just have to go and read it. In Hebrews chapter 12, the writer says, talking about what happened on Mount Sinai, his voice shook the earth then, but now, and I can guarantee you, Alan, when God spoke from Mount Sinai, South America was not shaking. But his voice shook the earth then. But now he has promised, saying, yet once more, I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven. I'm going to shake things up. Therefore, no, and this, yet once more, denotes the removing of those things which can be shaken as of created things. Now, the created things in this context was the tabernacle and all that man, anything handmade, man-made. The created things, in order that those things which cannot be shaken might be made. Sometimes you go and shake a tree and the fruit comes falling down, but the leaves stay up there. You shake up a society, what collapses? The rottenness of society, what doesn't collapse? The Christians in the society. Now, their society might be vastly changed, but their standing with God never does. It's not God's wrath against them. It's his purification. That's a different topic. But I'm looking at here at the shaking. Okay? Before the terror of the Lord, before the splendor of his majesty, when he rises to make the earth tremble, when we shake things up, those things that have no lasting ability will fall. And those things that do have that lasting ability will remain standing. In that day, men will cast away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship. What was he saying there, Alan?
That they're going to realize
they're worthless. They're on the way. They can't help me. And they need to be packed around, and I'm on the move. I'm on the lam. I'm trying to find a place of refuge. I can't, I don't need this. It's not helping me. So they're just going to throw it away. In order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, before the terror of Yahweh and the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the land tremble. Stop regarding man, whose breath is in his nostrils. But why should he be esteemed? What's he saying there? As we close, we're not going to get into chapter 3 at all. What's he saying there?
He's mortal.
He is mortal. But he's saying more than that. Stop regarding man. What are they doing? That he has to tell them to quit.
First one's the men of the
home. Yeah. Pardon?
When thinking of it's an idol.
Stop idolizing.
Yeah. Stop idolizing. There's another. Go ahead. There's another side of it. That's what I'm saying. All these are correct answers, but
who is man? It's just a breath.
Okay. Yeah.
He's not God. Why are you worried about these things that are not God?
When we get to chapters 37, 8, and 9, we're going to see Sennacherib making some horrible threats. Possible to regard the threatener. They worry about what he can do and be put, and by fear, be moved off my base. So stop listening to the guy that doesn't know what he's talking about. Stop worrying about the guy that's threatening you. I alone will be exalted in that day. And it's a choice. It's a choice people make. All right, I'm going to stop there because there's no sensing going on into chapter 3, even though we were supposed to get all the way through verse 12. You guys talk too much. I am determined that this will make sense. It's a complex, beautiful, rich, deep book that it'd be easy to get lost in. And I don't want that to happen. So.
He was talking about the trees. Do you think that maybe he was thinking the tree that he mentioned have different densities of wood?
Expand on that, Candy.
Well, different trees are different in their grains and their.
They are, yeah. But I think that gets into their functionality. Oaks were used primarily, well, not primarily, but they used oaks to make idols. Terebinth is oak. But oak was also used to make solid things. Cedar was ornate and very fragrant and durable. So palaces, kings' mansions would be lined with cedar. And the doors would be made out of oak because this of strength. Yeah. So you're talking about beauty and strength in those two, probably the main ideas there. And the other thing,